Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Stenziano, doing great. How are you, bro?
Always making it happen, big man. Got back from my Florida trip, visiting the G-Dad and family, and settling back in, so it's feeling good.
That's good. Yeah. Nice down here, wasn't it? Had a nice couple of days, brainstormed. Yeah, we obviously worked, bro. It was not a vacation. It was a working vacation, right?
Well, my daughter met Minnie Mouse, so it was a vacation in a little bit, so we enjoyed that. But anywho, guys, this is where we would normally plug for something to pay the bills. But now for our listeners, we're only going to showcase products and services that we approve or use in our own business. This time we're going to tell you about something of ours, specifically our Wheelbarrow Profits community. So Mr. G-Dad, you want to tell the folks a little bit about it?
Yes, Mr. J-Love. We've been working hard at growing our community of like-minded investors, and the results of our members has been nothing short of incredible. We've had some really great success stories the last couple of weeks. We're looking to grow this amazing group. What we're looking for is those who want to follow the proven framework we've created, buy right, manage right, and finance right, hence the Wheelbarrow Profits. We want to leverage our connections, education, and mentorship as ways to take your business to the next level.
So guys, you want to work with us, you want to find out more about how you can be a part of this amazing community, apply to work with us at jakeandgino.com. All right, enough shameless plugging. Let's get back to the show. Today's guest is Michael Becker. Michael is a principal at SPI Advisory LLC and heads SPI's Dallas, Texas office, where he oversees all aspects of property operations. He is a 15-year veteran commercial real estate banker and has originated and managed numerous loans in all major asset classes. As a portfolio manager, Michael directly oversaw the management and the financial performance of the countless C and B class multifamily properties he originated loans for. So without further ado, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Man, thanks for being here. Why don't you tell us about your corporate grind and how you got out and freed yourself in the multifamily world?
Well, yeah, as you alluded to, my background is in banking. That's kind of where I got started. I worked for, a few community banks, and my last stint in the banking world was at Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo bought my bank in year end 2008. So I spent about 5 or so years at Wells Fargo. And really when I first started out, I was loaning on pretty much any sort of income producing real estate. I did a lot of office, retail, industrial, and a little bit of multifamily. Then coming out of the recession, all I focused on was kind of value add multifamily lending and the BNC kind of niche grade, essentially. And I just led the nation 3 years in a row for my business unit, Wells Fargo. Just I built out a program to, renovate all these deals coming out of the recession. And we just did hundreds and hundreds of apartment loans over about a 3-4 year period. And kind of through that process, I realized I was on the wrong side of all these deals. It's better to be the borrower than the lender. And, I'm looking at all these guys I'm loaning money to. And I was like thinking to myself, like, I know as much or more about this than all these guys I'm loaning money to. I'm making a nice living, but they're out there getting rich doing it. So I went out and did something about it. So in about the last 5 years, starting in 2013, myself and my business partner, we've done about 5,200 units, over 25 deals, all here in the DFW market. And when we first started out, we did a lot of C-class multifamily deals. So in Dallas-Fort Worth, that's like 60s or 70s vintage properties. Some had flat roofs, some had, most of my tours. All the stuff I'm sure you guys are used to. Then now anymore, what we focus on are kind of class B to kind of A minus. So in Dallas-Fort Worth, that's about 1983 to 2008 vintage. That's kind of what our current focus is on.
He's snobbing on us, Gino. He's forgetting his roots where he started here.
I've had many boilers go out, cast iron sewers collapse, aluminum wiring, chill water systems, you name it, we've dealt with it.
So Mike, a lot of guys in your situation would be like, I'm comfortable. I like the corporate world. I like working for 4.5 days a week. I like the pay. What was your big why? I mean, it just can't be this guy's making more money. I mean, what was the big why that drove you to get into this, into the investing side of it?
you know, so I'm 40 this year, and really it was about my 35th birthday. I was kind of just looking around and going to whatever award banquet I had at Wells Fargo and looking at my boss's boss and seeing what they were doing. And that was kind of my future. If I stayed, I was going to be my boss and then my boss's boss. And I just got depressed. I was like, I just can't do it. I can't be the corporate monkey. And I was like, I felt like it was like, you know, it's metaphorical, but it felt really real to me. There was like a fork in the road. Like, I'm 35. If I don't go out now, like every year I wait, it's gonna be that much harder, you know, be that much closer, have that much more stock options, all that stuff, and just kind of make it that much harder to go out and do it. But I figured it was my moment, my time. If I went out and did it and I failed, I can always go back and be a banker. You know, that was my thought. So I was a good banker, I can always go back and be a banker, but I wanted to go out and take a shot and, you know, really have the pride in running my own company. And, you know, it's a feel good business, what we do, what you guys do, what I do. You take something that's underperforming, you know, the real people live there with their families. You come in, you can improve the quality of life, improve the asset. You can take investors' capital. You can give them a nice return that's better and more secure than what's in the stock market. So it's kind of a win-win-win business all the way around. So that's really what attracted me to it, on top of the ability to, you know, make, you know, pretty large gains and income as a deal syndicator.
So let me ask you, what advice would you give to people that are stuck in your situation? Because I was around 40 when that happened to me. I was a little bit older than you, but it seems like guys are middle-aged, have that middle-aged life crisis. They're either going to buy a Ferrari or they're going to get rid of their job and do something else. What would your advice be to people that are just stuck in that fork in the road?
I mean, you know, you really just got to go take action. I mean, fortune favors the bold, right? If you're in action, you're going to get the same thing, right? All those cliches, but really just got to go out and take action. I mean, if you're a confident professional and you're skilled in your trade, if you go leave, you can, I mean, most likely you can always come back to that trade if you fail. But if you don't go take the shot, I mean, you're never going to know. And then you're just going to be kind of the what if. I could think before I started doing apartments back in 2010, I started buying single family houses like a lot of people did. I was landlording, right? I did 15 or 16 rental houses. And I remember talking to my colleague who's about 5 or 6 years older than me at the time. And he was, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to buy this house. I'm going to rent it out. I'm going to make $400 or $500 a month. And then he was always worried about the risk and, you know, never, ever pulled the trigger. And I was telling him the entire time, and he's still at Wells Fargo and I'm not, you know, that's for sure.
So why single family homes? Why did you want to get into that space first?
Yeah, so really, in retrospect, I think that was probably a mistake. But at the time, you know, it was 2010, it was coming out of the recession. And as a banker, I was unfortunately had to be the Grim Reaper to a lot of people. You know, all those loans that went bad, I was the guy that had to go work them out and collect the money. So I found, you know, a few things that happened, right? So, you know, but one of the reasons why I saw a few deals fail were, you know, partnerships. So a lot of people have bad partnerships. They're mismatched. They didn't have proper expectations set on the front end. So I knew if I bought a little house, I put $15,000 down or $20,000 down, that would not bankrupt me if the deal went bad. You know, we can always sell it. We can always get out of it. So that's really kind of a proof of concept and really got my confidence together and really kind of helped me hone my skills on project management and construction oversight on a small scale that then we were able to then kind of scale up and get bigger. So, you know, it was helpful for sure, but, you know, I didn't need that and could have got right into apartments. You know, if I would have had the proper education, would have joined a mentoring group, would have got, you know, good education. There was plenty of programs out there in 2010 that I could have, that would have shortened a lot of that, you know, but that's why I started in it, you know, back 8 years or so ago now.
So what did people say when you left Wells Fargo?
A lot of them thought I was crazy because, you know, they thought the market was topping in 2013 and, you know, you're going to lose all your money and all that stuff. You know, my family was a little nervous. My wife was a little nervous. But, you know, on the way out of Wells Fargo, what I did was, you know, being a conservative banker, I ended up doing 4 deals while I worked at Wells Fargo the last 6 months. So we bought, you know, 4 deals, 800 units on my way out. We had a large equity partner who helped us kind of get those first 4 deals done. And, you know, so I had proof of concept again that I can come in, I can go out and, you know, execute buy. And so more than the confidence it gave me, what it really did is kind of help the marketplace change the perception of me. You know, I was a pretty well-known banker in my market, which is Dallas-Fort Worth. I did hundreds of apartment loans. So every broker, you know, the brokers get paid when the loans, when the deal closes and the deal loans until the loan does. So they all knew who I was. What my struggle was really switching my perception in the marketplace to a principal and you go out and buy four or five deals, and you know that changes pretty quick. Really, you buy one deal, that really changes after you do your first deal.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you said partnerships are really important, or the lack of having a good relationship. Jake and I think we have an awesome relationship partnership wise. What do you look for in a partner? And if you tell people they're going to partner with others, what are the things that you're looking for in a partner?
You know, so there's operating partners like yourself and Jake. So, you know, you guys have complementary skill sets, right? If you both have the same skill sets, one of you guys is unnecessary, right? So you need to have, you know, I'm fortunate when my partner is extremely analytical, you know, lives in a spreadsheet, you know, he's almost like a savant when it comes to that kind of stuff. And while I can do that, that's not really my strength. What I focus on is, you know, investor relations, construction management, you know, kind of BSing with all the brokers and trying to get deals in the door. You know, that's really kind of where my strengths lie. So just having someone with complementary skill sets for sure. And then on all the limited partners that you have, all your passive investors, if you're an apartment syndicator, you need to make sure that their interests align, their objectives for their money match with what your investment project is going to deliver. If, you know, you want to make sure that you don't take someone's last nickel in any sort of deal. You know, we try to only focus on accredited investors anymore, because I don't want to take someone's last $50,000 or half of their net worth to put in my deal. That's a lot of pressure on us. And I don't want that them sweating my deal if for whatever reason you own an apartment complex. Stuff happens along the way. And, you know, maybe you can't do a distribution that month or that quarter. And if they're depending on that money, you know, I certainly don't want to take someone's last nickel in a deal.
That makes a lot of sense. On your lead gen, where do a lot of your deals come from? Where do you find a lot of your deals?
So we had a couple different sources, but in probably 90% of the cases, there's been a broker involved in any deal that we've done. So we've done, 25 properties to date. I think 5 now have been marketed and 20 have been off market. But on the 20 off market deals, the vast majority of them have a broker involved. So, you know, that's the first tip I would certainly give anyone that's looking to get in this business, you know, the control of deals. So you need to make sure that, especially deals of size, you know, 100 plus unit deals, brokers control the marketplace. So you need to make sure you have a good relationship with the brokers. You need to go out and meet the brokers. You know, some of the things I would recommend that you do is, you know, this is not a business you can do behind your computer sitting at home, right? You got to go out. You got to get out and meet people, go to events. I know you guys have an event. That's a good place to go out and get to know and meet people. You probably don't meet a broker at an event like what you guys have, but you a limited partner or maybe an operating partner that you have, that you're lacking something that they have, that's a good place to maybe go out and meet like some partners like that. But go to a broker's event. So in my market and many major markets across the country, for example, Marcus and Millichap will have an event where they have like kind of their state of the market for the Dallas-Fort Worth market or Houston or New York or wherever you're at. Go there, and you know who's going to be there is all the brokers from Marcus and Millichap in that town. They're going to be there. You pay the $300 to show up, and then you get to go meet those guys. That's a good thing. People do business with people they know, like, and trust, right? So you need to get out there, go meet those people. Another thing to do is get on all their lists, and then when they start marketing the deals that they're selling, you know, go schedule a tour and go tour the deal and meet them. You know, that's a good way to go. You know, start that relationship and then follow once you do that. The brokers control the deals. You need to make sure you have a good reputation. You follow up. You do what you say you're going to do. And if you do those basic things, you have, you know, a good nation of a base to start in this business.
I have so many questions about your first deal, but I guess the first thing I want to talk about, you syndicated your first deal, correct? How did you structure that first deal on syndication?
So the first deal we did, I was fortunate enough that my business partner was at the time working for a broker out of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Who focused on high net worth individuals from LA and Orange County. And he found somebody that sold a company that had, you know, 10, 12 million bucks in the bank, something like that. And so we needed about $1 million to do the deal. So we got him to put in 95% of the money and I put in 5% of the money. So I put in 5% of the money, got 10% ownership, and I got a 1% asset management fee. That was really the basics of the first deal I did. I did the first 3 or 4 deals that way. And then once we got proof of concept, I then transitioned into kind of a more the model that we do today, which is about 15 to 20% of the deal is what we typically take today. But the first deal, I wasn't so much worried about how much money I made. I wanted a good deal. I did it right. I got it done and I returned capital. That was my first and primary focus, is really trying to set up the next 5-6 I can make down the road. But, you know, it all started with buying a deal and getting and doing a successful deal.
Is that, I guess, give people some, I guess, plugs, like a roadmap. What would your roadmap be to get into the first deal? Because everyone's always so worried about getting as much equity as possible in the first deal. I always say, get your credibility so you can build a credibility book. Do you have any tips on starting your first syndication?
Yeah, I mean, so that's it. So I wouldn't worry how much money you make on your first deal. I mean, you need to make some money. You need to get time, but, you know, don't be so greedy. I mean, the key is getting the first deal done and doing what you say you're going to do, or maybe even exceeding expectations. You know, you need to come in and start returning capital either through cash flow, you know, get a big pop on a refinance or a sale. That really sets up your career to go forward. That first deal is so hard, you know, so hard. You know, really what I guess kind of some tips, I guess, for the first time people, you know, this isn't an I business. This is a team sport, right? So go get some team members. And then when you're going out speaking to the brokers that control the majority of the deals, you know, if you have a partner that's on 400 or 500, you can go to the broker and speak with, you know, the truth that you and your partner have done 400 deals. We have done this, we have done that. So make sure you know, if possible, find someone that has some experience that can you maybe team up with and get into a deal. A lot of people start as like passives and other people's deals as well. That's a good place to kind of start that on your REO schedule. It's not as good or as impactful as you're the lead in the deal, but that's a good place to start. You know, you put 50 grand in this deal, 100 grand in that deal. That's a good place to start. The next thing I would say is, you know, you need to get a good team around you. You need a good commercial mortgage broker, need a good lawyer. And then the most important team member, in my opinion, is your property management company. You know, so if you're a first timer, you're coming into a market, you know, of size and scale, say like Dallas or Phoenix or someplace like that, you know, go to that market and you'll have a C-class apartment complex. You know, you just kind of go around and look at, you know, who's managing all these C-class apartment front complexes and the look at the ones that are performing the best there in the marketplace, and then start interviewing those management companies that manage that. That promise you the brokers will know who that management company is. So that's a kind of a data point or reference point for the broker that you're hiring a successful property management company in that market that specializes in the type of property you want to buy. That's kind of a check in the credibility box. So, you know, that's one thing that you should, that's one of your partners you should try to do. Or if you get qualified by, you know, a very successful commercial mortgager and they kind of give you the blessing that, you know, you're good to go on your debt, then the broker is going to take you seriously that, you know, hey, you know, they got the management down, they got the debt down, you know, do I feel like they can raise the capital? It's really kind of two of the three components are taken off that way.
What do you look for in a property management company?
What I look for a property management company, I mean, so what we look for is, someone that is experienced, that has a bench strength. Mm-hmm. You know, we started off with one management company, and kind of through the process, we hired a second one and kind of put them against each other. Finally, the second one won out. We sold most of the assets the first one was managing. Then we kind of actually transferred one or two over to the new one. But it's really about do they have a track record and experience, the type of asset and the submarkets that I want to own in. I don't want to be someone learning on my nickel, right? So I wanted to make sure I had a good quality record. That bench strength, you know, when I look at a management company, they really serve three main functions for you. They're going to do your accounting. So they're going to collect all revenue, pay or you, give you a monthly financial report. They're going to do construction management for you. So they might help you with some new capital projects on the exterior, but they're going to go over your units, make them ready if it's just a normal turnover, or come in and upgrade and change up the flooring and appliances and light fixtures and things like that for you. And then finally, they do HR for you. So all this that's on the on side of the property, they're the employees of the management company. You know, so they hire and fire and discipline the staff and make sure it's kind of running. And what I try to serve is I try to serve kind of the management role. You know, I kind of make sure that I manage the management company, that we set out a budget and we set up objectives together, and that I'm, you know, responsible to hold them accountable for what they said they're going to do in their budget. And that we're on track, or something's off track, we just figure out what's going on and try to course correct along the way. That's really what I see, but I would certainly look for someone that's been there, done that, and the type of asset you want to buy and own in the submarkets. I wouldn't hire, say, like Greystar is the largest property management company in the country. They manage over 400,000 units. I wouldn't hire them to buy to manage a 60-unit C-class apartment complex in suburban Dallas. That's not a good you know, you need to find the company that specializes in that.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You talk about Dallas-Fort Worth, and that's where your market is. If you have to go out and look at another market, what's your criteria for investing in a market?
I mean, so what I like is, you know, you need to have, you know, a good business landlord friendly environment, you know, so you need to be in a place that the, you know, doesn't take you 6 months to evict somebody. You know, in Texas, you don't pay, you're pretty much out in about 30 days. And there's, you know, many municipalities and states across the country that are similar. So I would look in areas like that that have, you know, good pro growth, business growth environment where, you know, companies are coming, you need job and population growth. And you need, you know, kind of have your average house kind of be, you know, around or below the median of the nation. You know, I don't want to be in a high priced coastal market. You know, we need it where people have good jobs that are, you know, reasonably high paying, but the cost of living is still affordable. You know, trying to buy stuff in Southern California on a two-cast is hard to make anything like that make sense. So kind of the middle part of the country, the South, the Southwest, the Southeast, those are all markets that seem to make sense generally. And then every market is a little specific. You know, Jacksonville operates different than Miami, as you well know. So, you know, Florida is good, but maybe Tampa or Jacksonville or Orlando might be better than South Florida.
You got to stay in the SEC, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. SEC. We have Texas A&M in Texas. So
I know you do, man. Qualify. That's what you're saying. Yeah. You count it.
That's great. Listen, when you bought your first deal, what was enticing about the deal? What, you know, what did you look for? What parameters were you looking for as cash on cash, cap rates? You know, let's talk about that first deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, it's not too dissimilar from what we look to today. Everything's just a little harder. Everything's a little tighter. Maybe the yields are a little compressed today. But, you know, really, we're targeting deals that are underperforming relative to their peers in the submarkets. You know, the kind of the magic rule of thumb that we look for is, you know, 10% or more below market rents compared to the competitors. You know, then we're looking for deals that, you know, have either management issues or physical issues or some combination of the two of them. Some of these deals pretty well capitalized. We're typically taking out 10 and 12 year fixed rate Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac debt. We come in these deals, we're kind of doing light value add. We'll spend $5,000 a unit on average. We'll come in, change up flooring, appliances, light fixtures, plumbing fixtures, you know, cure any sort of deferred maintenance on the outside, upgrade the office, the signage, pool area, things along those natures. And then kind of through that process, once you improve your asset, as these leases, you know, mature on you know, say about 8% a month on average mature, we'll come in, we'll raise the rents on renewals. Some will take it, some will move out, we'll update the unit, and we'll lease it out at $100 or $150 higher from what the previous tenant was paying. And it's kind of over time, you do it, you know, in over a year and a half, 2 year period, you completely move your entire rent roll and the property's worth a whole lot more. You know, from cash on cash, you know, it used to always be double digits. You know, we pretty much were able to get that almost out of the gate on most of the deals. That's becoming exceedingly harder to do today than it was 4 or 5 years ago. You know, now we're trying to hit double digits by year three, but moving up a little bit in quality, that's even becoming a little bit harder. So, you know, we're typically hitting 8-9% cash on cash year three and kind of mid to high single digits year one, year two. That's pretty typical anymore. And then we try to have, you know, double your money in 5 to 6 years. You know, so if you look at that on between cash flow and a, you know, hypothetical capital gain on sale, you know, if you give me a dollar, I need to give you $2 back in, you know, 5 to 6 years. So that's, you know, 14 to 18% IRR is kind of usually the sweet spot that attracts capital in today's environment.
And how do you structure it? Do you give a preferred rate of return in the very beginning, or is it just waterfall? And is it just at the very end?
That's the thing that can get super complicated. You know, a lot of people do this, the pref with the waterfall, and it's a 80-20 to 10 pref, 10-10, and then, you know, 60-40 and 50-50 above 18. So what we try to do is keep it pretty simple. We really haven't deviated much from what we've done. We typically compensate in three ways. We'll take an acquisition fee on the front end. We've charged anywhere from 1.5% to 3%, depending on the size of the deal. The bigger the deal, the smaller the percentage, right? Mm-hmm. The second way we get compensated is we typically take an asset management fee. So we're paying our third-party management company. We've paid them anywhere from 2.75% to 4% of collected revenue. But say, depending on the size of the deal, the more it produces, the smaller the percentage. But say we pay them 3%, we typically charge 1% for asset management. So it's 4% of collected revenue to the deal. And then finally, we're typically taking like a 20%, what we call sponsorship equity, or you call it carried interest. So, you know, we basically get 20% of the cash flow and 20% of the sales proceeds. And we don't pay a pref, you know. So that's kind of what we've done. It's really simple. It's really easy to explain to people. They understand it. It's a really simple calculation. A lot of people try to make this stuff complicated. So if you're out raising private capital, I would suggest you keep it simple. If you want to go more institutional and get, you know, the guys that went to fancy schools, unlike me, with PhDs and MBAs and stuff like that, then they understand the waterfall and pref structure with the IRR returns kind of graduating the splits up. So, but that'd be my suggestion. Keep it simple, have a simple split. Don't be greedy, you know, try to do more. You do good deals, you return capital. There's plenty to go around.
I'm glad you said that, because Jake and I have yet to do a syndication. We're at 1,000 units almost with all our own money. So we're struggling with this. We don't know how to do it, because I see these spreadsheets with the waterfalls, and I don't know about Jake, but my head wants to
explode. The waterfalls at Disney, man. I don't know what you're talking
about. I'm just saying, it's just
my advice is keep it simple.
Yeah, I like that 80-20. You have an acquisition fee, you have an asset management fee, and I think that's it's an awesome model. Do you have pushback when you say no pref rate? I mean, because we're struggling with that also, because talking to different syndicators, some of them say you don't need it. Some of them say, hey, these sophisticated accredited investors, they really want to see that they're getting that pref rate. What's your feeling on that?
Track record overcomes a lot, right? So we've done a lot of deals and we've been successful with it. If you guys done 1,000 units now, I would think your track record would speak volumes. Obviously, you haven't returned capital to other people, so you'll have to, do that for the first time. But it's not like it's your first deal and you're trying to go out and do something. You have a track record. You just speak to the knowledge. You guys have a platform with your podcast and doing events. I would think that it would certainly be easy enough for you guys to come in with whatever structure, either with a pref or not. What I don't like about the pref is it kind of disaligns interest a little bit from the sponsor to the passives. Because you might make a different decision on this investment because you're behind on your pref, because you have an 8 pref, but you can only been paid out 5%, so it's accruing against you. You're like, well, shit, I need to go sell this deal because I want to, you know, catch up on my crude pref and then go get out of it, you know. So that might not be the right decision for the deal at that moment in time, but it's the right decision for you guys as the sponsors. With a more simple, straightforward split, everyone's interests are more perfectly aligned than. Different returns. And then if you can't sell this deal for this deal for this amount of money because you need that extra 200 grand to get that extra split in your prep, you know, and you might not sell it and the recession might come, you know, it just disaligns your interest. So I think the best you can keep your interests aligned with your passive investors, the better.
I love that tip. On any of your deals, have you taken sophisticated and accredited, or just all accredited investors in your deals?
No, yeah, we have in the past. We're trying to get away from that a little bit more, just because it's just a little bit more liability on us as a sponsor. But there's nothing wrong with that. It's certainly allowable. My understanding, if you do a 506B, Reg D 506B raise, which is the predominance of the ones that we've done, you could take up to 35 sophisticated investors. You got to make sure you track it and you have a pre-documented, pre-existing relationship with those people. But if you do it, there's nothing wrong with it. My experience, those people tend to be a little bit more challenging once you take their capital, because a larger percentage of their overall net worth. You get what you pay for a little bit sometimes too.
You mean needy, right? Challenging is such a nice word. I see Jake laughing there. So yeah, because they're not accredited, they're not sophisticated, they don't know, they're throwing the money in there, and I'm sure you get calls every 2 weeks. What's going on? As opposed to, like, you know, getting your check in the mail every month. Is that correct?
Well, so we've been pretty good about not having that. So I think that, you know, key to kind of be proactive, make sure you communicate at least on a monthly basis with the financial statement. And nothing speaks more volumes than sending checks, right? So if we pay monthly, so if you project that you're going to hit 8% and you're only paying out 6%, you know, people might not be the most happy, but as long as they're getting some sort of money along the way, they tend to understand and be a little more forgiving is when you don't communicate or you don't send checks. That's when people tend to get a little bit more upset. But fortunately, we haven't had too many instances where that's ever had to happen. So
that's great. What is your, I guess, strategy on a lot of these deals or every deal specific? Do you want to refi these deals, keep investors in, or you just like to sell the deal off and move it into another deal?
So, it's definitely a depends answer. But kind of what I think about when we're trying to put together the strategy or a couple facets to it. You know, the first several deals we did were older, a little smaller, relatively, you know, 100 unit, 120 deals. And now we're trying to do 200 plus unit, little newer deals. So the older deals, we really wanted to kind of, you know, we came in, we bought them, we renovated them, we moved the rents, cap rates compressed along the way, which was nice. And we had big gains. So we decided, you know, for a myriad of reasons, we wanted to go ahead and sell them. You know, some of these were older, kind of more functionally obsolescent buildings. You know, they had cast iron sewers, asphalt parking, some had flat roofs, some had one had a chiller, multiple had boilers. So these are inferior construction components to what the newer product that is being built. So once you renovate them, you know, I like to describe it as you have all these like, you know, one-time non-recurring expenses, like your boiler goes out or you have 10 feet of your sewer line collapsing in your building, you got to dig up and it's 10 grand. But on these older deals, these non-recurring expenses recur all the time, right? So they don't hit your NOI, they're below the NOI line, but it's a real cash expenditure that you have to spend money on. So you have less of that on the better quality assets. That was one motivating factor to kind of move up in quality a little bit. And then the other was, you know, try to establish a track record as well, you know, be able to go full cycle. We've done 25 deals. We've got full cycle on 14. We've sold 11 and we've done 3 full cash out refinances. Another thing to think of is just Jake and Gino's money. You guys can refinance it. When you guys have investor capital, they typically want to see a return of their money in the medium term at least. So it's kind of hard to keep the band together forever if you have 20, 30, 40, 50 unrelated people. Having a return of capital and an end date to the project makes a little more sense the more people that you have in there. That's just something that I've experienced through kind of firsthand. You know, not saying it's always the case, but you know, the stuff that we own now, I'm a lot more apt to want to hold a little bit longer because, you know, we got concrete parkings and PVC sewers and pitch roofs and individual water heaters and stuff like that, washer dryer connections in our units, things like that. These are just much better longer term assets that will have less ongoing maintenance and some of the first stuff that we own.
What happens when you refi the deal? You refi a deal to these investors, you return their capital, split the refi proceeds. Do you keep them in the deal or are they refied out?
Yeah, so every time we've done it, everyone stays in the deal. So we refinance it and they're still in the deal with the original ownership percentage going forward. I know some people have done it the other way, but
they must be
but they also probably had a big cash return. Yeah, everyone's been We've been happy. I just finished up taxes about 2 weeks ago, and we did about 500 K-1s this year. So a lot of K-1s. Everyone's been pretty happy. I mean, I think we've done a really good job. I mean, we've bought right. We've managed smart renovations. And the market's been on fire for the last 5 years, too. So, you know, the winds have been in our sails for sure. You know, stuff we thought would take 5 years, we're getting done in 2. And I think our average R is like 60 or something ridiculous like that. You know, we never thought we could do that going in this deal. But, you know, we put ourselves in a good position to win along the way and well. And the market's kind of really pushed us forward to heights we never thought we can go.
That's awesome. Mike, when you look at a deal or an apartment complex, what do you not want to see in that deal? You mentioned chillers. I know chillers are horrible. You mentioned cast iron. What else are you looking at? It's a red flag for you now.
Yeah, so the first thing is just always location, right? So, you know, so I'll give that. I've said this before. So there's really, when I was a banker, there's really 4 things I observed as a banker as being the grim reaper in these deals that caused them to go bad. You know, so first and foremost, they bought in the hood. So buying in the hood is hard, right? Just lower socioeconomic areas have higher crime. It's hard to overcome that. You know, a lot of people are buying there now because they're chasing cap rates. But, you know, when the market turns, those are the areas that are going to have the highest economic and physical vacancies out there. You know, coming to these deals undercapitalized is another big mistake I saw a lot of people do. So making sure you do a good physical inspection, you set aside money up front to cure any sort of deferred maintenance, as well as implement your business plan, because trying to go get the money down the road from your investors is not a good option. You need to set aside up front. Having poor management, you know, back in the pre-recession, I saw guys that were UPS drivers, some LA small apartment complexes in Dallas to self-manage them. So that doesn't work very well. I can tell you the end of that story. And then just having a maturity at a bad time. So taking out 10 and 12 year fixed rate debt, especially this long in the cycle, you know, I mean, we've been long in the cycle. We're 8-9 years in the cycle now. You know, it's gonna correct at some point. And if you have maturity and it happened to be in 2009 when the capital markets were frozen, that's not a good time. So, you know, make sure you take out long-term debt. So that's kind of the four things I would tell people when, you know, I saw as common mistakes. So if you avoid those four things, you know, that's 95% of it. So what I look at now, though, is make sure first is location, you know, two, it has size. I mean, we're pretty much trying to be 200 units plus. The bigger they are, the more efficient they run, the more staff, you know, the more staff you can afford and the better quality staff you can afford. I mean, you guys have, you know, a less than 100 unit deal in a smaller town. I mean, you're paying your manager 30 grand a year. Whatever you pay your manager, and the quality of employee that's willing to accept 30 grand a year relative to one that'll accept 50 grand a year is materially different. So the bigger deal, the more revenue, better quality staff. So that's another thing we focus on. You know, again, trying to find stuff that has some sort of value add story to it. And then, you know, as we go up in quality, kind of we're buying some A-minus product now. I really want to be away from the supply pocket. So in Dallas and Texas, we like to build apartments. So I'm trying not to go in the corridors where they're delivering a lot of, not that they directly compete with us, because our product is 25-30% lower on a monthly basis on what they have to charge. But if I'm 10 miles away instead of, you know, half a mile away, that kind of insulates me a little bit more from some of the new supply.
I like that. That's a great answer. Last long answer question for me is, how have you built your teams and what advice do you have for team building? Because you've expanded in the last 5 years immensely. It's been like an explosion.
Yeah, so we started out, we had one employee, myself and my partner. We have, there's eight of us, we have six employees. So we've kind of had to get operations, you know. So the first thing I think you do is you get admin. There's a lot of $10 and $15 tasks that you have to do when you're kind of on your own. So the first thing I think you need is a good administrative assistant. Next thing we got, I think, was an operations lady. Got someone that was really, really organized, and we could track everything, and we built out processes and documented everything. We got an investor database and investor portal to kind of help manage a lot of communication, store K-1, store monthly reporting, things like that. And then we got, you know, we have a marketing person kind of helps us with some investor relations. We have a transaction coordinator that kind of helps us run all the escrows of the deals when we're buying or selling or filling out bank paperwork and stuff like that. And then we have an analyst who kind of really helps us. So that's kind of like the team that we built out, kind of almost in that order, really. We had the transaction guy would do some analytical work as well. Partner does a lot of our analytical work, but that's really kind of what we have. The next thing, and then finally, I think the last team member we added was asset management help. So having, you know, 25 deals spread all across, you know, right now we sold some, so we're about 14 deals today. So we're spread across, and it's a pretty major metro. So it could be, you know, an hour or drive from one property to the next. And it's hard to do that when you're doing everything else. So making sure you have some help kind of overseeing the management company, holding them accountable to their budgets, their plans. Those are kind of the types of employees that we've done. On the vendor side, you know, you make sure you got, obviously your management company is the most important vendor that you're going to have, unless you self-manage, and then you have to build that out internally with regional managers and accounting and stuff like that. You know, having a good commercial mortgage broker is really key, especially when you're starting out, making sure you get the right type of debt, the best debt quote on your deals, because debt can kind of make or break a lot of these deals as well. And then making sure you have all, you know, a good lawyer, and then making sure then you have all the other vendors. A lot of the management company will bring a lot of the other vendors for you as far as the contractors and all your services, you know, and then having a good commercial insurance broker as well to make sure that you're bidding out your insurance every year. And once you guys start getting the scale, like, you guys probably can start talking about having a portfolio policy now that you have 1,000 units. If you don't have it already, you shouldn't be on individual policy. You get a portfolio policy, you get a break on your insurance pricing by having some scale. So that was something that we started doing about 1,000 units, really. That was something that, you know, bigger is better in a lot of ways in this business, and that's one way that is better. You're writing down a tip there.
I am. I'm just writing stuff down here. Yeah, you know what? There's a lot to digest. I think guys have to know that it's not an easy business, but I think systematizing is really important. We're doing that with the Jake and Gino education platform right now. And it's just like a word that people throw around, but it's so nice to have somebody have all your systems in place. When you go underwrite a deal, you know exactly what to do. It's like a recipe. The first one's the hardest one because it's the first one. But once you create a system for it, it just makes its life so much easier.
Easier, it's 10 times easier to go from one to two than it is from zero to one. And then once you do it, like I'm telling you, all the brokers know when you buy that first deal, and they'll start taking you more seriously and bringing you opportunities that you otherwise would be.
I love that.
On the self-development side, your best tip for success you do on a daily or weekly basis that's helped you out?
You know, I'm not the biggest but try to be really honest with the way we do it doesn't necessarily mean it's the way. So we're always challenging everything we do. We're having, at least on a monthly basis, you know, we set out like goals for the year, and then we try to have on a, you know, monthly or at least semi-monthly, go back and review our goals and make sure we're tracking to hit those goals and try to constantly. One of the things I'll do is I'll kind of go down the rabbit hole on something. That's kind of one of my flaws I have personally. So we're trying to make sure that I'm constantly just focusing on things that generate revenue, the highest value tasks. Anything that's not a high value task, I try to push off to somebody else. So try to make sure I do that. I will have a tendency to get a little deeper into something than I really need to, and I try to snap myself out of it. But just constantly reevaluating what I'm spending my time on and focusing on that. You know, the as an apartment syndicator, you know, the way you generate the highest value tasks you have are either finding money or finding deals. You know, so you got to find capital, you got to find deals, and everything else is sort of noise. You know, it's all really important. You need to make sure you manage well, you use site selection, you manage your staff, all this stuff, the tax return stuff, all that things. But it's kind of noise. Highest value task is find money, find deals, and that's what I need to spend the vast majority of my time on, and try to get help for everything else.
Man, I can't remember who was on the show, but it was maybe Cameron Harold. I don't remember who it was, but he did like this role reversal with me to find like the highest and best use of my time. And it came back to finding deals. It was really interesting. It's just funny that you're saying that, man. It's so true.
That's it. Well, that's how you make money in this business. You find underperforming assets and you find the capital to take them down.
Yeah, that's great. What's the biggest mistake you've made since you've been in the business?
I've been fortunate not to make any sort of fatal mistakes. But of course the market's been so strong that, you know, anyone who's been doing it for the last 6 years, any sort of mistake they made. But really the biggest thing that I've done today, where, you know, say we got cut on loan programs, spiked or something, and we kind of limped in a little light on working capital or renovation dollars. Always come back and just made the deal. You know, we've always been able to overcome it. No big challenge. But you know, every time I didn't take that last $100,000, I didn't take that last $200,000 to do whatever, just make starting your projects a little bit harder. In this last environment, you know, the quicker you get in these deals, renovate these units, raise the rents, the quicker you get to the promised land. So just make sure, though, if you're on the fence about taking that last $50,000 or the last $100,000, do I really need it? I'd always say take that little extra working capital, because you can always give it back if you don't need it, but trying to go get it later is hard.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What would you have done differently when starting out?
When single family, as I did, I was ready to go. You know, I was a vendor in the market. I was underwriting deal after deal after deal as a banker. I've seen a lot of people really successful just joining mentoring programs, getting kind of in the community, learning from other people, success from somebody that's been there and done that. So if you're starting out, you know, education is the first thing that you need to have. You need to spend some time in it, listening to podcasts of your guys, reading your book. That's a good start. Then you need to then take it to the next level and really, really continue your education. Get around people that have actually done this, done what you want to do, that's a good place to start. So that would be what I would say, that a lot of people that make mistakes, they don't go through that process. The people that take specialized education tend to do a little bit better and really compress a lot of timelines and avoid a lot of mistakes. That in this business, when you're talking about buying multi-million dollar assets, you know, you make one mistake, it's more than cover the cost of any sort of education that you possibly have to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
What's a book recommendation that you have, either just general business or real estate related, that you found helpful?
You know, I'm not the biggest book reader, but one of the books I did read, which I thought he nailed it, was my buddy Ken McElroy. So Ken wrote the I never actually read his ABCs of real estate investing, but I read the Advanced Real Estate Investing Guide. And his philosophy and his business model is pretty much aligned with what we do. So I felt that really heartening when I read his book, that a really smart, successful guy like him has my business model is very similar to what he has. So I certainly recommend the ABCs of Real Estate Investing and the Advanced Real Estate Investing Guide by Ken McElroy.
Nice. What project are you excited about right now?
We're actually, I'm knocking on wood, hopefully today we're about to get awarded our first wrap construction deal. So that's, we'll have a structured parking in the middle, like a parking garage with apartments around it. So it's a really nice part of town near Left Field Airport, part of town called Bluffview. So hopefully we're going to get awarded this deal, and that'll be our kind of our first foray into that. So it's a little scary at the same time, because there's a couple unknowns that we never dealt with, the structured parking, and it's a little higher quality asset than what we have, but we think it's relative to what the older assets in Dallas Fort Worth are trading at today. We feel kind of the top end of the workforce housing, kind of low A, is really the better place to invest your capital as the environment today and the market that I invest in. So that's kind of the thing I'm excited about most right now.
I'm so excited for you, man. I want parking. I want parking lots. It's like my nirvana. Like if I could own a parking garage or a parking lot, I think it'd be the best thing ever. It sounds like a great business to be in. So tell us about your show and how listeners can get a hold of you.
Yeah, so appreciate that. So why, on top of syndicating apartments, you know, I'm affiliated with a company called Old Capital Lending. So we're a large commercial mortgage broker based out in Dallas Fort Worth. We'll do about $750 million in apartment loans a year. And we have a podcast, which I think is how you guys found us. It's called the Old Capital Real Estate Podcast. It's on iTunes or Stitcher or pretty much anywhere that we find me talking to you guys right now. You probably can find ours, or you go to our website, which is theoldcapitalpodcast.com. It's oldcapitalpodcast.com. So we have like a real life apartment owners, people that we loan money to, or brokers and service providers in the industry. We kind of get rid of it. So if you're an apartment nerd, which you probably are, if you listen to this show, then you'll probably like our show as well. You know, so that's the best way to kind of listen and learn a little bit more about it. Or you go to my company's website, which is spiadvisor.com. That's www.spi, like spy, advisor.com.
Very cool. And a little less Jake and Gino plug here. If you guys found value in this show, you can email gino@jakeandgino.com, a screen grab of your iTunes review, and the Mr. G Dad himself is going to send you a free book. So very cool. Gino, what else you got going on today?
I just think it's really ironic, or really similar, that Michael's path in investing in apartments is ours. We bought our first crack den, and I think our evolution has gone to where Michael has gone, like lower quality assets, but they cash flow like crazy. And then as you get bigger, you want to shed those smaller deals and start looking at the bigger ones. So think big, but start small, and then transition into the bigger ones. We bought 110 units in December, which I would consider a B plus asset. So it's very similar to what Michael's doing. So
man, it's A plus if you ask me, but you, okay.
Well, it's a B, yeah. Okay. But a B plus, yeah. but it's like very similar to what he's doing, right? It's like you want to start in and you want to just cash flow like crazy. So those C assets is where we started, and there's nothing wrong, because we just went back and bought another C asset in December. So, I just think it's really, really, really strange how we have the same exact path to start small and just start scaling up. So that's awesome. Great job, Michael.
You know, one thing I found, especially smaller deals, I mean, they're great. Like the starter properties, the 30 unit, the 40 unit deal, the kind of like starter properties. But one thing I found over the years, you kind of own apartments in dog years, you know, like every year feels like seven. So, you know, after 5 or 6 years, you're kind of ready to do something different, you know? So, mm-hmm. So selling kind of a small deal and scaling up, you know, either you get in this business, one or two things are going to happen. You're either going to absolutely hate it, and you're like, fuck this, I want to sell this property, never do it again. Or you absolutely love it, and you're like, man, I got to sell it, buy something bigger. You know, that's one of the two things happen. So, but starting with a 30, 40 unit, 20 unit deal, that's a good place to start. That's where most people start. And then you figure out if you like the want to scale up or just get out and go away.
I agree. Well, thanks, awesome. Michael, for being on the show. It was an awesome show. And like I said, you got to listen to Michael's show. He's got a lot of knowledge, a lot of information. Old Capital is a great company, so check him out.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, everybody.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.